while some EU countries such as Germany, Finland and Denmark have adopted restrictions on the arms exports to Riyadh, Italy and other EU nations have ignored the resolution in full so far.
It's unacceptable that Egypt, a country known for human rights abuses, is the top importer of Italian weapons across the world. Saudi Arabia follows. We can't accept that countries involved in wars continue to receive our military equipment. Unfortunately, Italy hasn't done much since the EU Parliament adopted the resolution.
An Italian government report has found that the Unit for the Authorizations of Armament Materials green-lighted 57 times last year the supply of military systems, including bombs, torpedoes, rocket launchers and missiles, worth about 200 million euros to Saudi Arabia and UAE.
One in four arms sold worldwide in 2019 were produced in Europe, according to a report by CIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. France and Germany topped the list of European countries that trade in arms, while Italy came third.
We often look at the US as the main arms supplier worldwide. However, we forget that Europe also plays a major role. If the European Parliament only issues resolutions and not directives, all those countries not observing arms embargo cannot be sanctioned. Furthermore, there is a lack of political will among EU countries for change. European companies even compete with one another to sell more arms in conflicting countries.
Consecutive Italian governments have also ignored a domestic law passed in 1990 which bans the exports of weapons in countries in a state of war. Italy's arms exports stood at over 5 billion euros in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
The United States presidential election continues to be unfinished and disputed. Democrat Joe Biden holds a slim lead, but President Donald Trump has significant public support from Republicans at the grassroots and elite levels to not concede. The election was preceded by months of controversy regarding the unprecedented use of mail-in ballots, which appeared to swing the election in the slight favor of Joe Biden at the last minute. A recent poll showed that a whopping 70% of Republicans do not believe the election was free and fair. Polls held just prior to the vote showed just half the number of Republican skeptics. Democrats say vote fraud has not yet been proven and that Trump must concede to prevent increasing distrust towards the nation's electoral process. But this is the third disputed election in the last six tries. Many are insisting that this election must be judicially vetted in order to prevent even more alienation, apathy, abstention, and anger. Others say the economic, social, and health disaster caused by the coronavirus makes this not the year to insist on transparency.
Six elections, that's my entire lifetime. So one in two of elections in my lifetime, and only I've been able to only vote in the last, I think, three of them. Or four of them. That says a lot about people's uncertainty of these elections, and that's just only going to grow if the system remains how it is.
The repeated electoral chaos is likely to undermine perpetual U.S. claims that their model of democracy is not only the best, but should be emulated around the world. Harvard ranked U.S. election integrity just 57th in the world. And that was last year.
This is not a model of a political system that would want to be mimicked. And it would only be mimicked if it's being used by the powerful. It would only be mimicked by them because they want something that undermines a majority view. And you should reject that entirely. If you really are for the small d democracy, if you're really for that, you would reject the American model of electing presidents.
The corporate-dominated U.S. mainstream media appears to have a united front that Biden won the election and that any legal challenges are frivolous. A significant percentage of over 70 million Trump voters don't appear to agree. Weeks of chaos and tensions appear certain as the Electoral College, the vote which actually decides the U.S. president, doesn't meet until December 14th. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that indirect talks between Lebanon and Israel will continue over the maritime border demarcation, stressing that this does not mean it will lead to normalization. In a televised address to mark Lebanon's Martyr Day, Sayyid Nasrallah said the talks were instead meant to be technical and set limits so Lebanon can benefit from its natural resources.
Many have written that the maritime border negotiations would pave the way for normalization between Lebanon and Israel. This is empty talk. We will never be a part of any peace talks with Israel. We consider its existence to be cancerous and devilish, and this will never change.
Sayyid Nasrallah also commented on recent Israeli drills along the Lebanese borders, calling it a demonstration of strength the resistance has established. He said such exercises proved the Israeli army was in a difficult state, where it has shifted its activities from attacking to defending. Sayyid Nasrallah made it clear in his speech that Hezbollah has strong, lifelong powers that will help it overcome any Israeli maneuver against Lebanon and guarantee victory in the region. He also made similar remarks towards the U.S. administration. Commenting on the U.S. presidential elections, Sayyid Nasrallah said he was happy at President Donald Trump's, quote, humiliating downfall. However, he said America's foreign policy will stay in favor of Israel, despite a new administration. In regards to the recent U.S. sanctions against Lebanese officials, including Gibran Basile, Sayyid Nasrallah said the U.S. is seeking to cause political chaos in the country and remove the resistance force from the region. He stressed the plan was doomed to fail.
What gives a government like the American one, which commits all sorts of terrorism and corruption, the right to label our politicians as corrupt and sanction them? We need to act upon our sovereignty and stand up against those American policies.
Sayyid Nasrallah said the U.S. has failed its many attempts to pressure the resistance and turn the Lebanese people against Hezbollah through the war in Syria and the economic crisis in Lebanon.
These sanctions will do nothing. They will not affect internal relations or cause conflict in Lebanon. The U.S. has been trying for years to cause inner rivalry. It has tried to weaken the strongest component in Lebanon, which is the resistance. This U.S. failure is a victory for the resistance and the Lebanese people.
For his part, Sayyid Nasrallah praised Lebanese officials, including Minister Basile, for their courageous stance against the U.S. pressure, saying it was for the sake of the nation. Rana Alaeddin, Beirut.
Pakistan and Iran have moved forward to expand their bilateral cooperation in major fields. During Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif's visit to Islamabad, both neighbors decided to expand their ties in the field of commerce, investment, regional connectivity, security, and people-to-people exchanges. The border management and geostrategic issues in the region linked with the security of both countries were at the center of the bilateral discussions. Iran has a long-standing concern over the back-and-forth movement of militants and smugglers at its shared porous border with Pakistan, something which also came under bilateral discussions.
We had a very good discussion on border cooperation, including border markets, as well as opening a new border crossing in Rimdan Gabit between Iran and Pakistan, which will happen hopefully within a week or two.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the political uncertainty revolving around Afghan peace deal after the disputed presidential elections in the United States amid allegations of electoral fraud. It remains unclear on whether or not Joe Biden will withdraw all American troops from Afghanistan by May next year under a peace deal between the current U.S. administration and Afghan Taliban in early this year. The huge financial and military losses in the 19 years long war compelled the White House to have a deal with the Taliban largely on the terms and condition of the militants, something which many in the U.S. believe is a surrender deal.
On Afghanistan, we have almost similar views. Iran wants peace and stability in Afghanistan, so do we. We have decided to have more frequent discussions on Afghan situation.
A
few weeks back, Donald Trump said that the U.S. forces are going to withdraw, even they will have the Christmas in America. They are that much in rush. But, you know, after the, Democratic government, when they come into power in January, so I think they have a fear of change in the policies. This is the most important subject which foreign minister of Iran and the Pakistani authorities discuss.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the hideouts of the Daesh militants in Afghanistan, which they fear may be harder to dismantle if the peace deal derails. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Clerics from major monotheistic religions gathered here in Tehran for an important goal: to promote peace based on religious commonalities. Delegates representing Islam, Christianity, and Judaism unanimously agreed that the root cause of intolerance and extremism lies in the lack of dialogue among religious leaders.
The divine books of Christianity and Judaism both speak highly of the last prophet named Muhammad. The Holy Quran has a special chapter about Saint Mary and Moses. So religions don't have any issues with each other. Therefore, it is upon us scholars to raise awareness and enlighten the minds of our people to respect other religions.
This session comes against the backdrop of repeated acts of blasphemy in France against the sectaries of Muslims. Scholars slammed the French government for lending its support to the growing anti-Islamic rhetoric in the country. This as President Emmanuel Macron argues that he seeks to promote freedom of speech. These people say freedom of expression is praiseworthy, as long as it does not contradict the right to freedom of religion.
What the French president says is merely based on his deeply entrenched racist mentality. His comments on Islam have nothing to do with free speech. His actions are aimed at spreading Islamophobia to further marginalize Muslims. Now you tell me, is this freedom of speech or is it suppression of Muslims' right to a free religion?
Iran is home to different religious minorities, from Christians and Jews to Zoroastrians. All are represented in the parliament. Scholars believe peaceful coexistence among religions hinges on a collective effort by religious leaders to sit and talk based on their commonalities.
Representatives of different religions here say what the French president describes as freedom of speech is in fact freedom of hate speech, not only against the sanctities of Muslims, but against all monotheistic religions, since they believe in the same God and honor each other's prophets. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على خير خلقه وآله الطاهرين.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and may His peace and blessings be upon the best of His creation, Prophet Muhammad, and His pure progeny. Millions of Muslims are proud to follow Prophet Muhammad. At the beginning of the call of Islam, their number could be counted on one's fingers. The Holy Prophet's program was so vast that it covered all the fields of human life, be it politics or economics, morals or anything else. Moreover, his program was perfect in every respect. In the beginning, the Holy Prophet did not demand from the people except the acceptance of the belief in the two witnesses, that is, belief in only one God and in his being the Prophet or Messenger of Allah. The Holy Prophet's great work had started on a little measure. He created the atmosphere little by little and issued commandments one by one for each and every aspect of human life and guided the entire humanity with such a great program that it changed the course of their life tremendously. One of the secrets of success is to refrain from following others blindly. It is because such thoughtless following amounts to a war. It is because such thoughtless following amounts to a war against our human nature. We should not start copying those deeds of others for which we are not competent. We must also understand that the tendency of copying others in every way leads to a failure. As a rule, if the personality of some people remains defective, and if they sometimes face failure and deprivation, it is so because they start moving without keeping in mind the extent of their ability. They ought to have made up their shortcomings by following some other path. Becoming proud, envying others, remaining unaware of facts and situations are the defects which make men copy others blindly, even though, right from the beginning, they know nothing about what is to come at a later stage. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
News Live.
Not so long ago, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia was stood on the stage at the Nobel Hall in Oslo, receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts in achieving peace and international cooperation in resolving the border dispute with neighbouring country, Eritrea. Move forward to today, and the Ethiopian Prime Minister is refusing to enter any form of dialogue over an ongoing ethnic conflict in the north of the country, with some allegations now suggesting that war crimes could be being committed in the region as the battle rages on between the Ethiopian military and the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The United Nations lead on human rights, Michelle Bachelet, has stated that the situation is spinning out of control, leading to heavy casualties, destruction, and mass displacement of people, something that the region is very much ill-equipped to cope with, leading to a potential humanitarian disaster. But for the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Ahmed Abiy, he's making very serious claims that the Tigray people are responsible for acts of treason and terrorism, something that has seen the conflict see the Ethiopian military step up their efforts in sending resources to the region to quash the notion. Yet it seems that the scale of the operation is causing disturbing reports emerging from the area, with witnesses claiming that they've seen Ethiopian forces bombing civilian areas, as well as ground operations that have seen shooting on the streets, as well as machete attacks. So what is the real source of this conflict, and why have tensions escalated into a full-blown civil war, in spite of pleas by the international arena to halt the fighting?
When the current Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power in 2018, he decided that he was now going to eliminate this old structure, and he proposed a new party called the Prosperity Party, which would not be based on any nationality, not Tigrayan, not Aroma, not Amara, etc. And the TPLF rebelled and didn't want their power challenged with this new structure.
What now remains to be seen is whether the fighting will cause the conflict to spill over into neighboring countries, something that could lead to further issues in the region. Ethiopia is no stranger when it comes to seeing masses of people flee from its nation. The 1980s saw famine force hundreds of thousands of Ethiopians away from their homeland in search of food and water. And yet again today, the same dilemma is in force, yet this time with people fleeing conflict. Estimates have already placed over 14,500 people, half of whom are children, as fleeing the conflict zone, with many of them heading to Sudan, with aid agencies stating that more could follow as the situation becomes worse. With the tensions now spreading outside of the Tigray region in the form of an attack on an airport in the neighbouring state, the notion that refugees could start abandoning Ethiopia from other parts of the country could have a detrimental effect on the region and could draw in the presence of neighbouring countries into the fold. Yet as the conflict escalates and no sign of diplomacy is on the immediate horizon, the situation in and around the Horn of Africa could escalate into a regional war as neighbouring states and international actors form alliances and allegiances based on their own goals, setting off yet another disaster in a region that should instead be embracing a post-colonial peace.
Britain and the European Union face another fast-approaching deadline to conclude marathon talks on their future relationship. December 31st is looming, but the remaining differences are apparently still very significant. The two sides are trying to hammer out an agreement on their future ties that will include a crucial trade deal, security cooperation, and rules in areas like fishing access. The talks are tough, with each side pushing to get the other to make more concessions. Battered by the devastating impact of the coronavirus pandemic, businesses in Britain urgently need a trade agreement that would minimize disruption in January when the country officially exits the European trading system. But top EU officials are taking a tough line on Britain and are unwilling to budge. A summit of EU leaders on November 19th is widely seen as the final deadline for a draft deal. The situation has piled pressure on British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who is a key architect of Brexit. It seems to be scrambling to make trade deals with other nations like the United States to make the UK less dependent on a deal with the European bloc. He has used the possibility of clinching trade deals with other countries as a bargaining chip in talks with Brussels. Johnson wants to get the EU to believe that Britain can easily survive even if it leaves the bloc's trading system without a deal. He has long been pinning his hopes on a fast-track free trade deal with America. Boris Johnson was among the first world leaders to congratulate Joe Biden soon after media projections showed that he won the presidential race. Critics in Britain and the U.S. have dismissed this as insincere, as members of Johnson's cabinet and Tory lawmakers had openly supported the re-election of the incumbent president. Things will probably be a lot different if Biden takes office in January. Unlike Trump, Biden has made it clear that the withdrawal agreement, which set the stage for Britain's formal departure from the European Union, must be respected. This means Biden doesn't like a no-deal Brexit at all. Meanwhile, Biden speaks very proudly of his Irish roots. He has made it clear that the 1998 U.S. broker Good Friday peace deal for Northern Ireland must never be violated. That, some believe, is a warning against a bill pushed by Johnson that would violate parts of the EU divorce agreement governing the border with Ireland. Biden's stance may weaken Johnson's position in talks with Brussels.
And we've got a much closer relationship between the Democratic Party and Brussels. So this is going to be bad for Britain, no doubt about it, when it comes into next year. But don't forget, this deal has got to be signed by the end of 2020. And so Trump is still going to be president at that point. When the negotiations are going down the line, that's one of the reasons why I think the European Union will be doing everything it can to make sure there is no deal at the end of the year.
Top EU negotiators know all too well that a balance is changing. The British Premier now has to perform a delicate balancing act. He has to come up with a way to pressure Brussels that does not antagonize Biden. Johnson faces a mammoth task. Is he up to the job? The British Premier faces a race against time, as any agreement has to be ratified by the European and British parliaments before the looming deadline.
The beautiful game, as they call it, was supposed to bring people from around the world together, enabling nations and races to mix on the field, playing a sport loved by all. Yet, it seems in England, the beautiful game has an ugly side. Not from the fouls committed by the players during the match, but from the very top of the governing body ruling the sport, the FA. The chief of the English Football Association, which is one of the world's oldest and most respected, has resigned after a storm ensued, following the use of language used by the boss when describing black players making their living in the English leagues. Greg Clark was forced to apologise after he used the word coloured to describe black players, a term that's derogatory in nature and highly offensive. Furthermore, he also used other discriminatory slurs against other minorities in the sport, including women. One would have imagined that the UK of all nations would have taken note of the protests sparked by the murder of George Floyd in the US, with the protests even hitting the streets of the UK in the process. Yet it seems that the banners, adverts and campaigns to stop racism in Britain are facing an impossible battle, in particular when the very highest echelons of authority are themselves racist. Football in particular is most interesting in England, with players taking to their knees before each match as a sign of respect to the Black Lives Matter protests. Yet, as one professional football describes, the only disease in the world right now that appears to be unbeatable is racism, with Raheem Sterling himself suffering horrific abuse on the pitch from racist fans. But the truth of the matter is simple. Britain has been pulling the wool over the eyes of many by claiming that racism doesn't exist in the country. However, this could not be further from the truth, as no matter how many television adverts portray mixed-race couples living together, or the government placing token black and ethnic minority ministers in seats, the fact is, Britain is racist to the core, from the top down. So how then can Britain truly put an end to this horrific discrimination, with this in mind?
It's certainly true that there have been a lot of efforts by governments, both Labour and Conservative, over the years to try to tackle the problem of racism, including in sport and especially in football. But as we saw in the case with Mr. Clark, who used a term to refer to black spectacle, which these days is not acceptable. He very quickly was under pressure to resign and accepted that what he'd said was unacceptable. But what's happening is that in all parts of society and all companies, including sports companies, basically people are going through what's called unconscious bias training. In other words, they may not think they're racist, but they need to learn how to relate to people of different ethnicities and what sort of language to use so as not to be unintentionally racist in their behavior.
Across the UK, the race divide is highlighted more than ever around the towns and cities of the country, with many of the poorest areas having large populations of black and ethnic minority residents living within their boundaries. This has sparked a subconsciously racist approach in the way that certain institutions deal with such minorities across Britain. For one, the police, who claim to be improving their diversity quotas, are one of the most racist institutions in the UK, with one ex-officer claiming that being a minority in the police means dealing with racism by one's own colleagues is a daily occurrence. With racism clearly an issue within police stations around Britain already being a major factor, things are even worse on the streets, with reports claiming that the Metropolitan Police in London, which is the UK's most diverse city, is more than four times more likely to use force on black people than on other races, hence cementing the point further. But such issues can be seen around the nation, with more favourable facilities being granted to white British people over ethnic minority races, ranging inequality at educational institutions, housing, medical care, social benefits, and fighting poverty, with the racism filtering top-down when it comes to how certain areas are dealt with. In spite of high-profile faces, such as Manchester United star Marcus Rashford, aiming to get the government to wake up and feed the disadvantaged proportions of the population, it's the case that the UK government and its range of institutions are simply picking and choosing who they help, based not on merit and need, but on race and social class.
When the first black and Asian immigrants came to Britain in the 1950s and 1960s, they did indeed take much of the low-paid work in the public transport sector, in factories, cleaning jobs and so on, and so the communities were much poorer. Since then, there has been greater social mobility, though. We see black people and Asian people in as university professors, Mayor of London, several government ministers, though still there are a lot of BME people who are in the lower paid job.
Canada has always boasted itself about its human rights records on the international stage. Yet a recent report by Human Rights Watch says there's much to be done regarding human rights in Canada. According to the report, there remain considerable challenges to undoing decades of structural and systematic discrimination against Indigenous people in Canada.
We had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that involved the truth-telling of the residential school system several years ago, and it came out with over 200 recommendations for Canada as a whole to take action to reconcile and to remedy a lot of these issues that are contributing to these violations. And it's very, very slow going.
Inadequate access to clean, safe drinking water, federal government's reckless discrimination against Indigenous people by denying them funding for child and family services, and widespread discrimination against First Nations women and their descendants are just a few examples cited by the report.
Canada has failed to remedy its treatment against Indigenous peoples in this country for hundreds of years. It's the ongoing assault against our people in this country. It's the legacy of colonialism and Indian Act policies that are oppressive against our people, the remnants of the residential school legacy that left our people very broken.
Back in September, the world was shocked after an Indigenous was left dying in a hospital after being mocked and insulted by the medical staff. The gruesome death was a reminder of systematic racism in the Canadian society. Back in June, the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, launched by the government in 2016 to address endemic levels of violence against Indigenous women and girls, released its final report. The inquiry made 231 recommendations and concluded that acts of violence against Indigenous women and girls amount to genocide.
So in regards to the water crisis that we have, at any time in Canada, there's approximately 100 First Nations across the country that have lack of access to clean drinking water. It's so bad that just a few weeks ago, an entire First Nation community in Northern Ontario was evacuated.
The Human Rights Report also blasted Canada's government for detaining children in immigration centres. According to reports, 118 children were detained or housed in a detention centre in 2018 to 2019. The Canadian government has also been criticised for interfering in the affairs of other countries. Canada has consistently meddled in the affairs of Venezuela. It has imposed several rounds of sanctions and temporarily suspended its diplomatic operations in Caracas. In June, Canada announced sanctions against Nicaragua for its alleged human rights violations. This interventionist policy has been in line with Washington's policy against leftist governments in Latin America. The Canadian government is also under pressure to end its $15 billion arms contract with Saudi Arabia. Canada has yet to suspend existing arms sales to the Saudi-led coalition, despite policy guidelines urging close control over exports of military equipment to countries with a record of human rights violations.
And Canada should not just say, well, I'm sorry, there's commercial considerations and there's the fight against terrorism by Saudi Arabia. What has happened in Yemen is terrible in terms of human rights. And the fact that Canada would pay a penalty is not relevant when it comes to human rights. And you know, Canada is one of the only countries now, apart from the United States, that hasn't done anything. Germany has suspended.
Canada is yet to release the findings of its 2018 review of military export permits to the kingdom. Canada is also under fire to hold Myanmar accountable for the genocide of Rohingya Muslims.
The Limelight.
Donald Trump continued to rage against the dying light of his U.S. presidency on Saturday, 14th of November, falsely claiming to be the victim of mass voter fraud and praising right-wingers and conspiracy theorists who gathered in Washington to echo his fabrication. Trump emerged from the White House to applause, cheers, waving, and whistles from hundreds of supporters lining both sides of the street. They punched the air, took pictures with mobile phones, and held signs that included "Best President Ever" and "Stop the Steal." The article you're about to hear has been written by The Observer journalists Oliver Millman, David Smith, and Samira Sadek. The piece is titled "Arrests in Washington as Trump Supporters Assemble Rejecting Biden Victory." Stay with us for more of Oliver Millman, David Smith, and Samira Sadek's article. Donald Trump continued to rage against the dying light of his U.S. presidency on Saturday, 14th of November, falsely claiming to be the victim of mass voter fraud and praising right-wingers and conspiracy theorists who gathered in Washington to echo his fabrication. Trump emerged from the White House to applause, cheers, waving, and whistles from hundreds of supporters lining both sides of the street. They punched air, took pictures with mobile phones, and held signs that included "Best President Ever" and "Stop the Steal." The crowd also waved flags, including "Trump 2020, Keep America Great," "Trump 2020, No More," "All Aboard the Trump Train," and "Trump 2020, Pro-Life, Pro-God, Pro-Gun." A stand had been set up to sell merchandise, as if at a Trump rally. Some ran excitedly after the motorcade. There were chants of "USA, USA, we want Trump, we want Trump, and four more years, four more years." Fringe extremist figures such as InfoWars founder and conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, Enrique Tarrio, chairman of the far-right Proud Boys group, and Jack Posobiec, who promoted the infamous Pizzagate conspiracy that led to a 2016 shooting at a Washington restaurant, spearheaded rallies that Donald Trump called heartwarming. Hours later, after night fell in the nation's capital, demonstrators favoring Trump clashed in the streets with counter-protesters, with videos posted on social media sites showing fistfights, projectiles, and clubs being used. Police arrested at least 20 people on a variety of charges, including assault and weapons possession. According to officials, one stabbing was reported, two police officers were injured, and several firearms were also recovered by police. President Trump has still not conceded that he lost the 3rd of November election to Joe Biden. Despite a protracted count showing the Democrat has comfortably secured the Electoral College votes needed for victory, seizing formerly safe Republican states in Arizona and possibly Georgia, where a hand recount is underway. Across the United States, Joe Biden has more than 5 million more votes than Donald Trump. The president has refused to cooperate with a transition of power to Biden, who will enter the White House on 20th of January, or even provide his successor with national security briefings. Donald Trump continued on Saturday to claim without evidence that the election was rigged and that he's the rightful winner. On Friday, 13th of November, federal and state officials said the election was the most secure in American history. With no evidence, votes were compromised or altered. Plenty of Trump supporters accept the president's assertions, however, with thousands rallying in Washington in demonstrations organized under titles including Million MAGA March and Stop the Steal. One attendee of the peaceful daytime rally, Mike Sembert from Fort Myers in Florida, told The Guardian he had come because "We need our president back, and we need four more years." Mike Sembert said the election was fraudulent and votes were cast by illegals and dead people. Anti-Trump protesters have also continued to congregate in Washington since street celebrations erupted when Joe Biden's win was confirmed a week ago. Signs, some reading "loser" and "failure," have been plastered on a non-scalable fence erected around the entire White House perimeter. "There has been an outrageous and illegitimate attempt to overturn the election, which must be stopped in its tracks by people in the streets, making clear that the election is over," said Sunsara Taylor, a counter-protester. Joe Biden won and Donald Trump lost. The courts, as well as the major news organizations that typically project election winners, appear in no mood to indulge Trump. The president's campaign has suffered a slew of legal losses in Michigan, Arizona, and Pennsylvania after arguing that ballots were illegally counted. The Trump campaign keeps hoping it will find a judge that treats lawsuits like tweets. Justin Levitt, a Loyola Law School professor and elections law expert, told CNN. Justin Levitt added, "Repeatedly, every person with a robe they've encountered has said, 'I'm sorry, we do law here.'" The bulk of senior Republicans have either sided with Donald Trump or refused to condemn his refusal to acknowledge his loss, a stance that will lead America down a dangerous path, former President Barack Obama has warned. There are some notable Republican exceptions. George W. Bush, another former president, has congratulated Joe Biden on his win. The tumultuous transition comes as the U.S. is ravaged by a surge in coronavirus cases. On Friday, 13th of November, a new daily record of 184,514 infections was recorded by Johns Hopkins University, with Americans now dying at a rate of around 1,000 a day. Nearly 250,000 people in the U.S. have died due to the coronavirus pandemic, by far the worst death toll in the world. Joe Biden has urged people to take basic precautions such as wearing face masks, whilst attacking the woefully lacking Trump administration response to the crisis. "I will not be president until next year," the president-elect said. "This crisis does not respect dates on the calendar. It is accelerating right now. Urgent action is needed today, now, by the current administration, starting with an acknowledgement of how serious the current situation is." At the march, counter-protesters in Washington said supporters of the president attacked them. Sansara Taylor, spokeswoman and co-founder of RefuseFascism.org, told The Guardian her group was part of a nationwide protest to stand on the victory of his electoral defeat, to oppose Trump's attempt to overturn this election. Around 11:15 a.m. local time, Sansara Taylor said, about 15 to 20 activists convened at the west end of Freedom Plaza, just near the White House, and started setting up signs. "Because there were a lot of Trump supporters around, it was elbow-to-elbow crowded," she said, "so the activists decided to move into the street. His mob of supporters descended on us as soon as we set off," Taylor said. "They assaulted some of us. They grabbed, they shoved. Every single person had hands put on them by multiple MAGA meatheads, but we held it together. We marched together. No one was seriously injured in the incident." Taylor's group then regathered, she said, in Black Lives Matter Plaza, the stretch of 16th Street Northwest near the White House, which was renamed this summer. After dark, there were multiple confrontations as small groups of Trump supporters attempted to enter the area around the Black Lives Matter Plaza. In a pattern that kept repeating itself, Trump supporters who approached the area were harassed, doused with water, and saw their MAGA hats and pro-Trump flags snatched and burned amid cheers. As night fell, multiple police lines kept the two sides apart.
Can you talk about something unique that you derive from the faith that can be of benefit to any other young Muslim that's aspiring right now that sees the mechanics of political success, but not necessarily the religious grounding?
I think one of the things that I realized people would overlook is the amount of time necessary to invest in the spiritual side of yourself, in the introspective, reflective element, and in seeking out people who will be your best critics. For me, it was extremely important to find, whether it was my mom or spiritual mentors in the community who could point out to me my flaws, or who knew me before and could guide me otherwise throughout. And I honestly don't think anything is worth sacrificing your relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and certainly some of these paths can do that. And so if it's not about taking those measures before, fortifying yourself, you are building up, you're cultivating an immunity system over years to be able to sustain you just for a couple of months of something like a campaign. You had built up that immunity system for yourself that even your worst moments will still, inshallah, be within a certain guideline. So that's extremely important. And I would say prioritization in the times when we're most busy reflects what our values are. And if we don't make that time to sit down with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to make istighfar throughout these times, because there are so many ways that we fall short, then ultimately Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala won't bless that work for us. It's that fundamental connection. So I think it's being deliberate and intentional about finding that time, and then those people who will tell you the hard things, you know, hearing the worst about yourself.
What is the biggest difference in your life that Islam made outside of the realm of faith, pre-Islam Eduardo versus post-Islam Eduardo?
Well, Islam teaches us that the difference between a believer and the difference between a disbeliever is like the difference between the living and the dead. Islam gave me life, and Islam gave me purpose. It gave me the ability to navigate with the world with a sense of confidence as to where I am from, where I am now, and where I'm heading. And that clarity, like what you were saying, Abrar, you know, about being intentional and being deliberate is so important, because if you don't have a goal, you can't score. It's pure and simple. And Islam allowed me to have the paradigms which brings about the best of myself. I think I would summarize it to that: insight, perspective, and a clear sense of orientation.
Was there ever a time that you thought about going back, a breaking point? What was the most difficult test you faced as a Muslim? Because we know that a lot of people convert, and then unfortunately they don't find the support system, or tragedy comes, and they're forced to make a choice, and they go back, right? So can you tell us a little bit about that, if you ever had a breaking point or a moment where you thought, maybe I didn't make the right choice here?
It did happen, where I had a breaking point where I felt that it was very difficult. It was a very heavy burden to carry on my shoulders. What was the hardest was that I didn't have a lot of confident Muslims around me, as I mentioned before. And when you're vulnerable, meaning your friends are judging you, people are pointing the fingers at you, talking behind your back, and you're just in that space where you genuinely feel misunderstood, sometimes you question yourself, right? But I had full certainty that Islam was the truth. But the difficult environment in which I was kind of kept me going back to my old ways. All the resistance that you're facing everywhere, and where people are just looking at you, and almost as if people look at you like you're weird. They don't understand you. And we all want to be validated. We all want to be felt. And I was everything but felt. So I had to give up on a lot of my old habits. The struggle was real. It was very difficult. But I'm so grateful that I met some good people that allowed me to make big mistakes, and that accepted me with all my imperfection and all the obnoxiousness that came around being someone that had such a bad past, and give me that room to gradually, one step at a time, grow to be where I am today. Alhamdulillah.
A theme of Confident Muslim has been that in every Muslim public figure's life, they face a breaking point, or they face, similar to what Eduardo was talking about, they face a moment where I can compromise on my values or I can stay strong. Usually compromise yields an immediate reward. Commitment means a lot of hardship is going to be in front of you, and your path to success is that much harder. Muslim women in particular, who are disproportionately impacted by Islamophobia, are also disproportionately criticized within the Muslim community, right? We hold our female Muslim leaders and figures to a much higher standard than we do male Muslim leaders and figures. And you're also getting bombarded on the outside, bombarded on the inside. Tell me about that moment for you, or what was that moment where you had to make a choice that you can go back to, and you chose to power through and maintain commitment?
It definitely was not easy within the Muslim community. And alhamdulillah, I even came in with some level of a footing where my family had been serving the community for many years. But even that, I had people, there was a brother, may Allah guide all of us, who came up to me and came up to one of my volunteers and said, you know, if you're not married and you can't run a household, don't think you can run a county. And there were comments like this, and even navigating our spaces, right, and having to give an announcement or engage people and who the gatekeepers of the community are and who the leadership is, was certainly not without challenge. But I think it was always important to remember the compassionate elements there. That of course I'm upset, and I don't accept that our Muslim community would have things like this and reactions like that, but trying to tap into that deeper sense of compassion and understanding and empathy for where that person was coming from. Because at some point, you have to make the decision that the work is bigger than you. I have to care about my circumstance and my reputation to a certain extent and my health and whatnot, because the work is affected by it. When you kind of abstract yourself and realize that it's much larger than you and your personal experience and what's going on to you and what people think of you, but it's about, again, the cause and the broader mission of elevating humanity and addressing injustices, then I think there's a strength that one can derive from that.
Tell me about what role your mom has played and what role your conversion has played in the relationship dynamics between you and your mother.
She basically made the field fertile for the seed of Islam to be able to plant and grow. She's someone that I see as a Muslim, but she hasn't really accepted faith because of the Catholic background and all the negative experience she had with religion. But my mom is something that teaches me Islam as a Muslim. Like, I spend time with her and I see her as a teacher. She'll literally tell me stuff like, one day I was with her and I'm like, Mom, are you happy? And she says, no, I'm not happy, but I'm at peace. Like, okay, can you explain? And she tells me, well, how can you be happy in a world where there's so much suffering? Even you, look at your brothers and sisters that you're trying to help in Gaza, right? And the Syrians and the Yemenis, their suffering is real. How can you be happy in a time like this? You have to be selfish. And she's not trying to be sophisticated when she says this. She says it really from the bottom of her heart. But she says, I'm at peace because I'm doing everything humanly possible for me to be able to make a difference in the world. Even look at yourself as Muslims. You don't say, happiness be upon you. You say, peace be upon you. So peace is the ultimate objective. And I'm like, mashallah. Like, I'm learning Islam from you, you know? So.
May Allah bless Mas Ikna. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala allow us all to find certainty in our faith. Jazakumullah khairan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio.